Welcome to the pod, everyone. A shout out to SGS.
Hey, Rusty, why are we partnering with SGS?
Some good people there, pretty excited about their sports coaching courses and sports courses, keen to make them industry ready. So when people leave, they're able to go and transfer it to any kind of industries, coaching, teaching, being an analyst, business, whatever it might be. So I think, I think it's pretty exciting times, really.
So what's so special about their degree courses that others wouldn't be doing?
I think it'll be lots of real good partnerships, opportunities for people to get into different contexts and learn and practice. It'll be feel very applied. People will be stretched and supported and will leave ready to just go and thrive in the big old world out there.
SGS College is the home of Bristol's higher education sports programmes. The programmes are designed to develop unique, innovative and creative sports practitioners ready for industry. Do you want to be a coach or teacher of the future? Start your journey here at SGS College and become more than just a graduate. Visit sgscol.ac.uk to apply now.
Cool. Rusty here. Welcome to the pod. Jeremy Holt. How are you, mate? You well?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Rusty. All happy here, survived lockdown, moving forward. Did face-to-face rugby for the first time last night, so that's always nice.
Nice, and how were the lads down at Hove Amateur Rugby Club?
I just think really pleased to get out on the pitch and see each other again. I would describe it as a bit chaotic, a bit hectic. We're all learning because we, trying to run rugby training in bubbles of six people for 16, 17-year-olds, 30, 16 or 17-year-olds being told to keep in their bubble is a bit tricky. But we do our best. And I think that over the coming weeks, we'll get better at it. And hopefully the regulations will change soon anyway, and we'll be able to go to bigger group sizes.
Nice. So, lots of clean hands in Hove. As you said, you're in a communal park, so you are fully adhering to all the social distancing and all the rules. But
We have to have hand washing stations, and then we have to sanitize balls and all sorts of stuff. So that's part of doing your duty, really, isn't it?
Yeah, nice, cool. Well, look, it's good to have you on the pod. I was lucky enough to go and spend a bit of time down in Hove with you, and we had a meeting previously. I'm always intrigued by your work. Even more intrigued now I know that you're doing a bit of stuff in Speedway and Bristol. Bristol Bears was part of my childhood. But do you want to kind of explain briefly how you got to where you are? What's your story?
Yeah, sure. So my background, I'm an occupational psychologist. Been doing that for 30 years now. So I started off working exclusively in businesses, doing a lot of selection and assessment and development. Then probably about 20 years ago, I started focusing in on teams and leadership of teams. And so originally that was all in corporates. About 13 years ago, I started doing stuff for the military. So I put together a high performance teams module, which I started running for senior officers at the UK Defence Academy. So that broadened the sort of spectrum of what I was doing. And then back in 2013, I think it was, I got a call from someone at Lotus Formula One team to say, would I come and do some work with them in their pit stop crew? So, of course, I thought, yeah, that sounds interesting. Went and did that and then started getting more involved in applying the stuff that we've used in corporates and in the military into sports teams. So since then, I've worked with British Olympic hockey women's team, worked with Warwickshire County Cricket Club, did a bit of stuff with the Royal Navy rugby team. Who else is there? Worked with one of the Scotland rugby coaches. And then more recently, I've been working with Great Britain wheelchair rugby team. And as you said, Great Britain Speedway team.
Right, there's one
and
thing.
Hove Colts,
the mighty Hove Colts. I said to you when I spoke to you the other day, like Speedway just reminds me of the smell.
Yeah, Speedway's an interesting sport. So I mean, I'd never been to a Speedway meeting until I was invited to come and see what it was all about, to talk to the managing director of Great Britain Speedway. And they said, look, why don't you come up and watch one of the meetings? So I went up to Manchester, to Bellevue, and watched it. And that's the thing that strikes you. It's the smell and the noise. And it's a very visceral kind of sport because it's a small area. The races are over in just about a minute. Four laps, there's a lot of crashing and excitement and danger, and it's all happening right in front of you, so it's actually I think it's a sport which, so in the UK anyway, it's sort of a bit underrated. It's sort of died away a little bit, but you go to somewhere like Poland, it's still as big a sport as football, soccer, over in Poland. So they get crowds of 30,000-40,000 watching it there.
Oh my days. Modern day gladiators. What stuff have you been doing with Speedway?
So I think any international setup that you're working with, I don't think it matters what the sport is. There's a challenge, which is first of all around people are riding for their clubs or playing for their clubs. So there's sort of loyalty to their clubs. Speedway is an individual sport, so they're all competing with each other as well. And we're trying to pull them together into a team where they can learn from each other, where they can all improve their performance, and where they can build their commitment to Great Britain, so that when they pull on the GB Kevlar suits and, you know, have got the Union flag on their chest, it means something for them. So that's the overall picture, is sort of pulling together that sort of real sense of pride and loyalty to the Great Britain setup. And then beneath that, we put in place a performance program. So I'm working with a guy called Chris Neville, who is the head of S&C for the England football team for 13 years. So we got the physical side, and then we got the psychological side. And then obviously there are the managers who coach around the technical, tactical side. Trying to professionalize it. And what we talk about a lot is just we're there to borrow, beg, steal other people's ideas. You know, we're really trying to break the mold and be open to possibilities of different things that could be done. And I think that there's loads of scope for sports to learn from other sports and the way things are done in those other sports.
Nice, and I would clearly endorse that for you, having been in lots of sports. One of your areas of specialism is the psychology of teams. Let's either with Speedway, or I'm definitely curious about the pit stop, because that's where a team's got to work pretty effectively together in a really short space of time. What's your model? What's your stuff? What's the advice you've got around this?
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe we take the example of the pit stops. So you've got, I think it's 16 people go out and do a pit stop. They are from, they're engineers in the garage. So they're selected from a group of about 50 who are allowed into the garage during a race. They're volunteers. And it's really public, right? So if you mess up, it's really, really public. And if you do well, then you get a little pat on the back, but you know, it doesn't really sort of, it's the driver who gets the credit. So there's a lot of pressure for people who basically are amateurs in what they're doing there. So what was happening at Lotus was that there wasn't really, I would say, a sort of cohesion within that group of mechanics. And so, what you saw then was that affected the way in which they trained and the way in which they practiced. So they've got a practice set up in their factory, and the idea is that they practice their pit stops every day. But intensity wasn't really there. All the kind of stuff that you would look at, you'd walk in there and say, if you were coaching this, here are some things for you to think about. So there was a lack of, I would describe it as a lack of real sort of commitment and buy-in. So the sort of stuff that I do is trying to help people to think about themselves as us rather than me. So it's creating that sense of togetherness. And if you look at what drives performance in teams, there's a very strong correlation, and you could argue it's actually a cause, between a strength of togetherness, thinking us, and how successful a team is. And that cuts across. It doesn't matter whether you're in business or in sport or in, you know, jumping off a helicopter in Afghanistan. It's the same thing that's in play. And the way to think about it is it's to do with who you are. So we tend to have a view of who we are as if we're an individual operating in isolation from the world, and we have a personality. So we talk about people's personality. We talk about, you know, their sort of characteristics. We talk about character, don't we, as if it was a static thing. We say, oh, that guy's a leader, or that guy never leads, and so on. So that view of the world is that sort of, I don't know quite how people think it happens, but you're formed at some point and then you're finished and that's it, and you're never going to change. But actually we know that none of that is true. The reality of who you are is that it's dynamically formed. And part of what defines who you are is, you know, your childhood experiences and your genes, and that's the sort of stuff that might be considered to be personality. But part of who you are is also defined by your membership of groups. So when you categorize yourself as belonging to a group, what you start to do is you modify your behavior to fit in with that group. So you sort of have a stereotype view of what happens in that group, and you modify your behavior to sort of self-stereotype to become one of those sort of good examples of a group member. And that has a profound effect on how you behave. So it's happening dynamically all of the time, which is why people are so wonderfully complex. Why someone who can't lead their way out of a paper bag in one context could go to another context and be a really effective leader. It's why, you know, countries go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump. And, you know, why would people vote for Donald Trump when he doesn't have any of the characteristics that we would think of as a leader? Well, it's because for the group that look at him as one of us, he represents what they want to have represented. So therefore, they vote for him. So the way that that plays out is you've got these multiple aspects to who you are. Some of them are really important and some of them are very trivial and unimportant and very transient. So what you're trying to do in sport is you're trying to create this sense of identity so that people can say, that's a group and I categorize myself as a member of it. And then to focus that identity on whatever performance is in your context. And then you get motivation, you get buy-in, you get behavior change, you get selflessness, that kind of thing. So yeah, that's the pattern.
Nice. So many questions, and probably
got me talking. That's always good.
No, it's good. Fletch often talks about, you know, the same person would behave differently in the library to the nightclub. And it was interesting. I'd referenced this last night, but I had a coach in New Zealand I was speaking to, and he said, "Oh, how was?" And I won't name the coach when he was in England. And I said, "Oh, you know, did a like real like positive impact." Etc. And he said, well, he's the opposite over here. And it's like really interesting that different contexts, but also I guess the, you know, so in New Zealand, the players are much more responsible for their own development. So when they see someone, they might see him as a teacher or an instructor, whereas over here, they might go, wow, this guy's pretty far out. He's trying to encourage us to be in, you know, take responsibility for ourselves. So I would see it all the time that it's contextual. When you talk about, so can we go back to probably the word that I'm most frustrated with at the moment, as you know, because every time I ask the question, I get a tech answer. When you use the word identity, what do you mean?
So identity is my sense of myself. So it's my self-esteem, if you like, my self-concept. And so, as I say, it's got these two components. There's my personal identity, which is the me. So if you think of yourself, imagine you had an hour and you could do anything that you wanted to do, and you're going to do it on your own, not representing a group or anything. You do anything that you wanted to do. And what you chose to do in that circumstance would probably be highly influenced by your personal identity, your individual identity. But take you in that hour and now put you into a group context of a group that matters to you. And what you choose to do would be profoundly different. And that's because that's your social identity that's coming into play. So who you are is a combination of those two things. So what, when we then sort of extrapolate that up to a group level or a team level, so people talk about team identity as if it was the same as culture, and the word is used sort of interchangeably. But from a psychological perspective, it's quite different, really. It's quite a distinct meaning. So a group identity is a shared set of beliefs that underpin this emotional attachment between individuals and the concept of the group. So at the core of it, the bottom line is, it's a set of shared beliefs. And there are two important things to know about those shared beliefs. One is that they are, the best way to create a shared belief is to co-create it. So you walking in and saying, "This is us, get really excited, lads," not likely to be so effective. You going in and saying, "Lads, let's talk about who we are. Let's talk about the kind of team we want to be. Let's talk about where we've come from and where we're going. Let's talk about what we do that matters. Let's talk about what it means to belong and to be one of us. Let's talk about what's going to make us effective. And let's talk about what makes us different." So five fundamental beliefs. If you can have conversations about those five fundamental beliefs, then what you're starting to do is create a situation where these beliefs will become shared, and they'll move, converge towards a sort of shared understanding and agreement. And that's the essence of shared identity.
Nice. My experience, and I'm just going to play out some stuff that I've heard or seen. That's a meeting at the start of the season, and it's done. Tick that box. The co-creation is fairly one-sided. We often don't talk enough about where we came from and what's the stuff that's got us to this point. And yeah, that's something I've probably become more mindful of recently, and I think it's been like fletched as a piece of work where you almost draw it a bit like a buyer tapestry of what got us to this point and then where do we want to go to. And then I guess maybe my question is, so how have you seen people keep it alive really well? So you know, because I think this is my view isn't, and I might be wrong, this is an iterative conversation. This isn't a bang, we've nailed our identity, this is it. This is something we probably explore and discover together, but we need to keep it alive.
Yeah. By the way, I just wrote down Bayer tapestry because that's a really good way to describe that. We do an exercise which we call the timeline. So I'm now going to call it the Bayer tapestry.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that would be getting the person who's been in the team the longest time to start and say, when I joined. So I did this with Warwickshire County Cricket Club. And so there was a guy in the team, I think he was the kit man, and he joined when he was 16 in 1972, something like that. And he'd been with Warwickshire since then. So I was working with them in 2016, and he'd been with them since then. And so we just started the story. And what you do is you say, if you imagine there's a line and you can put above the line a positive times and below the line a negative times.
Yeah.
And then just fill in and get some post-it notes, write some words on it. And then the next guy who joined says, "Oh yeah, I joined in 1979. And then he joins in as well. And then you get up to the current players who actually don't know any of this history. I mean, so Warwickshire won the treble in 1993. Okay, so I think that's the only county club to have won the three domestic trophies in one season. And there was the director of cricket at the time, Dougie Brown, had played in that team. So this guy's got amazing organisational wisdom about what's made this team successful in the past. And all these other people have as well. You know, you've got people like Ian Bell, who started playing there when he was 6 or 8, something like that. Jonathan Trott. And they just started to share this wisdom and this understanding and unpick it. And you imagine yourself as a young player coming into that situation. That's gold dust, right? That's absolute gold dust. So doing those kinds of things, if you've got a team that's sort of got some length of life. So in our situation at Hove Rugby Club, what I would try and do is get past players to come back. So we got a, you know, if you look, back over the years. The players who've gone on and played at Premier, Premiership. The players who've gone on won caps. And so if I can get any of them to come back and talk about their time and what they learned and how it's helped to move them forwards and what they've learned since, that all helps to build this idea of continuity over time. So the fundamental belief here is I am much more likely to be motivated to buy into something, to buy into a group, if I believe that it is that there's a connection over time, if the past is connected to the present and is connected to the future. So, I mean, if you've read James Kerr's book Legacy, which almost everyone in rugby has, I reckon, that's about this idea of connection. So the Maoris talk about having your time in the sun, and they say, you know, we're connected with our ancestors and those who come after us. Like a chain of people connected, and the sun moves along the line and it shines on a different person, and at some point it will shine on you, and it doesn't matter how brightly it shines on you or for how long it shines on you. Your job is to keep the chain going. Your job is to make sure that you pass the sun on to the next person in your lineage, shining as brightly as when it started shining on you. So legacy sort of emphasizes this thing about connection over time. And I think that lots of people kind of get the point of that. I know James quite well. James could have called the book Belonging, and then everyone would have sort of had a completely different emphasis of it. But he chose legacy, so that's what we all talk about. But that wasn't your question, was it?
No, well, and you've triggered me on a couple of things, and we're going to go back to your question. But Owen, Owen Eastwood's writing a book called Belonging at the moment, which I'm really excited about. You just triggered me on a couple of things. One was that when you mentioned the kit man, I would recommend watching the movie Marvelous. Ian Bell is one of three cricketers that I've met and have no idea who he was. He's with Marcus Triscothick and Don Bess. And the third thing that made me think the most, so I've been having this debate a bit. So I played for Bath a very long time ago and was the light shone on me for a very short period of time. But someone put on Twitter the other day, it was they do a Bath rugby podcast, and I kind of half, well, I seriously, but I think they thought it was joking. They said, who should we get on the podcast? And I said, Martin Hager, Nigel Redman, and talk about identity. There's no connection with one of the greatest club teams ever now. And actually, I'm aware that there's been people in that environment that have actively discouraged that connection with the past, which I find really interesting because, I think some of the stuff you spoke about, like the motivation, the emotion that goes with belonging and being part of something greater than us is really powerful. And I think that could be something that, I'm surprised people don't want to harness that energy.
Yeah, it is odd, isn't it? When the stuff I was doing with Matt Taylor, who was assistant coach at Scotland last year, one of the things we talked about was what's the player journey. So, in healthcare, they have this idea of a patient journey from the first touch through to the sort of being discharged fully healthy again, one hopes. And we were talking about the idea of a player journey. So small boy in some field in a glen in Scotland dreams of playing rugby for Scotland. What does he dream of? What's the content of that dream? And then how is that reinforced as he comes through the age grade system? So that when he pulls on the jersey as a full international for the first time, there's a consistent narrative that sits behind it. And part of that narrative is not just how do you attract, how do you induct, how do you maintain, but it's also how do you exit. So when someone, your international career ends when the phone doesn't ring, right? and that's it. And gradually you realize, well, that's three times it hasn't rung. It could be curtains. And when I was working with Warwickshire, that was Belly's situation. It was the end of his England career and he wasn't sure if the phone was going to ring or not. And it's really quite disconcerting. And so what happens is that's become a big part of your identity as an individual. And then it just ends. So part of what we were talking about is if you were really trying to build a performance culture in in an international sports team, then you need to think about what's the identity that motivates people to adhere to that culture. So culture is about what we do, and identity is about who we are. And part of that narrative is, what do we do with our, you know, the people who've gone before us? Now, you talk about Owen Eastwood. So knowing Owen a little bit, and Owen did some work for Stuart Lancaster before, back in 2013, I think it probably was, or 14.
Yep.
And I was talking to him about that. And part of what he did was he researched the history of England rugby. And I don't know, have you done a pod with him? Or are you doing one? Or
no, he's on my
he's too busy, mate.
No, very. I did ring him recently and spoke to him for an hour or so, and it was I was pumped speaking to him, and I'm pretty excited about his book. And he's done a podcast with Stuart that I share with a lot of people, because, like you, I think he's definitely into some stuff that people are, you know, we're just not that mindful of, in my experience.
So what he did with Stuart was, he got a budget and he went away, and he just, his job was to research the history of England rugby. And the output of that was a film which was shown to the players before 2015. And he showed me that film, and it, you know, it's like watching an episode of Coast, you know, it's swooping,
yeah, it is.
Swooping down the valleys to a church where there's a small boy, you know, dreaming of playing rugby for England on this occasion. And what does the red rose mean to you? And it was really well done. But some of the horror stories of the way that past internationals were treated by the RFU were just shocking, absolutely shocking. You know, so I think they're allowed a ticket allocation after, you know, if you've got a cap, you're allowed two tickets or something like that for internationals. And people being told, well, no, you can't have an extra ticket. I can't remember the name of the player, but I think he wanted to invite his friend John Jeffrey to come along and watch an England-Scotland game. And he was told, no, you can't have an extra ticket for that. It's like, really? Are we sure? You know, bizarre.
So that's a conversation with people of, yeah, the people who leave your organisation, what would they say? You know, because I think that's, you know, how people leave us and still feel connected and feel like they were supported afterwards, and would be critical, in my opinion. That comes up a lot. So I think, yeah, I said to you, I did a pod with Ugo, and Ugo mentioned that. Yeah. And I speak to lots of ex-players who've, you know, done countless amazing things for their clubs and would still feel very disconnected.
Yeah, yeah. And if you contrast it to business, so one of the most successful organisations in the business world is McKinsey's consulting firm. And what McKinsey do is that they deliberately maintain a very strong relation with their alumni. And the idea is, you come in, you sweat blood and tears for McKinsey for 5 to 10 years, and most people will leave. You know, they won't be able to hack it, but they look after them so well. It's like being a part of an exclusive club. And so that sense of being, you know, it changes your motivation when you join, if you know you're going to be looked after when you leave as well. So anyway, that's one of the areas is around that idea of continuity over time. That's one of the things you'd want to build.
And so you've mentioned the word motivation a bit. What's your view around that?
I suppose one way to think about it is that motivation mediates between sort of that core inner bit of you, so your personality, and the outside world. So it's partly driven by your individual values, and it's also partly driven by your need to belong. So there's a psychologist called Eric Erickson who talked about one of the fundamental bits of work that people do is sort of handling the paradox between wanting to be an individual and distinctive. So, you know, you're born a nice little pink mushy sort of thing, and you're indistinguishable from your mother. And then that's fine when you're a child. But then as you move into adolescence, the whole job that you're doing is to distinguish yourself from your parents, right? To be different and to sort of forge your own sense of self. So that's a really important part. But at the same time, we have a profound need to belong. We have a profound need to know where we're included, where we're safe. And it's deeply inbuilt. And if you think about it historically, you can understand why. So you go back to, you know, when we were cavemen running around on the savannah, if you were excluded from your village, you died because you got eaten. And that followed right the way through until the Industrial Revolution. What's that, about 180 years ago, something like that. So you've got something like 240,000 generations of humans, of which only the last 13 have been in a post-industrialized world. So that's an awful lot of evolution, which is basically saying, if you can't fit in this small static community, you will be excluded from it, and that's the end of your gene pool, really. That's your toast, you're in trouble. So we're really finely tuned, and I'm sure you can think of it yourself, you know, to notice whether we're being included or excluded. And we just pick up on it instantly. It's a little gesture, or it's a word, or something happens, and we make sense of it. And what you get when you feel excluded is exactly the same neurological response that you get when someone punches you. So it's triggering exactly the same part of the brain as social pain triggers the same part of the brain as physical pain. And it does exactly the same in terms of your chemistry. So, you know, you get adrenaline and cortisol will fly through your body. You get that fight flight response, and you're pumped to either run away or fight or freeze. But it's not good for you, right? So we're trying to handle this dynamic between wanting to be individuals and wanting to belong, because we need to belong. When we feel that we belong, it's the opposite. So serotonin is released into the body, oxytocin, so the happy hormones, if you like, make you feel relaxed, make you feel good. They're called endogenous opioids because they are basically the opioids produced in your body. So it's a really nice high feeling when you feel that you belong somewhere. And it's really good for your brain. It's really good for your body. So we're trying to feel that we belong, and we're trying to be distinctive. So the way that people do that is that they join groups which are distinctive. And then I belong to something, but it's not the same as my mum and my dad. It's something different. And so that's a pattern that then you follow throughout your life, really.
Nice. Well, hence, that's why Hove Rugby Club exists, I would imagine.
And all... You know, if you think of volunteering in amateur sport throughout the country, it's insane what people do to because they feel a sense of belonging about the place, and it has a meaning for them and it matters in their life. So it becomes part of themselves.
Yeah, interesting, because my daughter's about to move to big school at the end of next year, and that's become a real an interesting transition, isn't it? Because all of her current friends... I mean, it looks like everyone's going to different schools.
Right.
And so, that's interesting watching that play out. One of the things you just did then that Owen did a fair bit when I spoke to him was almost take it back to the plane. So back to caveman, cavewoman times.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
Because I think that understanding... Well, let me just step back from that a minute. There are different branches of psychology, okay, and the branch which I'm most interested in is called social psychology. So that's about humans in group situations. It's about humans interacting with other humans. It's about relationships, and that's been studied for, I don't know, probably seriously for about 100-120 years, something like that. And we've established some theories, and there's been a lot of really good research into what makes us do what we do. But actually, what people find convincing is to understand where that might have come from. So to understand what the theories tell you, it helps to position it just in terms of why it's there. And so I think looking back at, you know, genetically why we've evolved to be the people that we are, and how that's been, I mean, if you think about everything that's ever been achieved that's been worthwhile, it's been achieved through collaboration. You know, teams are absolutely fundamentally at the heart of everything that we do that's worthwhile. And they're a profound source of what gives meaning in our lives. So understanding the context of why that might happen, I think, is helpful. I don't know if Owen does it for the same reason.
Yeah, no, it would, yeah, I think it's exactly the same reason of actually how much of our brains evolved. We're still wired towards to belong and to be part of the group because we're much more likely to survive.
Yeah,
we would have kind of some inbuilt negativity biases around, you know, just to yeah, it was just interesting that, I'm just intrigued by it. The other thing, I mean, I'm really intrigued by, so they included or excluded stuff. I actually, something that when I speak to players a lot, and they would feel part of a group that they don't agree with the stuff that's going on, but they almost feel socialized into it. So I kind of thinking that, and I probably had 2 years of that at the RFU where I was, you know, you're trying to change stuff and nudge it, but you're definitely thinking this isn't right. And I remember that being really kind of stressful. So yeah. You spoke about the, you know, the cortisol-y type stuff. And I think it's quite energy consuming. I mean, what would your work say around that? So the kind of, does once you establish an identity, does that kind of sometimes people need to leave, or what's the stuff that's going on around that?
Yeah, so usually political cliques exist because there's an absence of an identity which is holding people together. So what you're doing is you're creating some sense of identity with other people who perhaps you've considered to be like-minded to you. And so that's where you start to get politics and sort of subgroups and cliques in organizations. And that happens because there's an absence to take care of this overall sense of us and togetherness. Now, of course, the bigger the organization becomes, the tougher it is. I don't think the RFU is that big. Is it? I don't know how many people work there.
Yeah, there's a fair few. I'm actually not thinking about the RFU. I'm just thinking about some people that are involved in teams where exactly what you said, I think there is politics. And I think, well, I know because I've asked them, like, what is your identity? What makes you unique? That they've never been through that process. I think they've done the one afternoon on culture.
Yeah. So so you get cliques because there's a lack of a shared identity, I would say, at a sort of team level or an organization level. So what I would say, and I think this is true for anyone who's leading anything, and that I would include coaches, because basically that's what they do, is that what you're trying to do is create that sense of togetherness and us, that sense of shared identity. You do that by having conversations, and we can talk about what you do after the conversations. But as that grows, you present people with a choice. So for people in that, you know, who are in those cliques, perhaps, they may still say, I don't want to be part of what's emerging here. But at least now there is something that they could be part of, and they may choose not to be part of it. And that does happen sometimes. But if you sort of think of it the other way round, so let's imagine you're a coach. I mean, we always call it the Kevin Peterson problem. So Kevin Peterson, probably the most gifted batsman of his era.
It was my next question. I was going to go to Last Dance, but let's go to Kevin Peterson.
Yeah, you could do Last Dance. I mean, you know, you could think of Danny Cipriani. I mean, there's
and that was the other one I was thinking of.
Yeah. So, you know, hugely gifted, but actually did England. So you could blame Peterson for, you know, I mean, I think towards the end there were some tweets from the dressing room to his mates in the South African dressing room and all that kind of rubbish. So you could blame Peterson and say, oh, he's a difficult person, and that's why this has happened. And that's great. You know, if you're happy with letting someone who's the greatest talent in the world at the time slip out of your team, if that's what you think a good job is, then fire away. But if you think that the job which you're there to do is to embrace talent, then what you need to do is create a stronger sense of us which attracts him in. And the way you do that is you get him involved in creating that sense of us. Now, that might be difficult to start with, and it might require a bit of humility for you as a coach. But it also requires some confidence. And the confidence you have to have is that we together in partnership, players, coaches, performance staff, you know, whoever's involved, that we together will produce something better at the end than any one of us groups could produce on our own. And it will be better, not because it's necessarily a better solution, but because it's our solution. and therefore we're going to go away and execute it. And that's the key thing, isn't it? Doing it.
So what do you think the implications for leaders are and coaches of, you know, some of the stuff you're thinking about? We chatted just before around the, you know, often the historical view is the kind of the great man or the great woman theory. And I think this is an interesting leap. I chatted to someone the other day about vulnerability, really, and they said, well, some of us have just, that was just frowned upon all our life. You know, I've had 30 years in sport of, you don't show your weaknesses, you don't let anyone else in, you make the decisions. What have you noticed in leadership?
So I think you're right. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a great woman theory, because great men theories are written by men, and they tend to just emphasize that how great men are. I mean, this is a big thing within the military, as you can imagine. So if you think of the history of military leadership, it's been around celebrating the great generals and field marshals who've enabled us to have great successes. But the work I was doing at the Defence Academy, so this is a course for senior level, so once you get to colonel or above, officers, and also security services, so MI5, MI6, GCHQ, those sorts of people, is to sort of move away from that paradigm of thinking that leadership is about me and it's about some inherent quality in me, because there's no research that suggests that's true. There's no research that suggests that there is a characteristic which great leaders have. So actually what is true is that leaders are successful when they play certain roles in groups. So you really have to think about the follower more than the leader. And what do followers need to want to follow somebody? And what followers are interested in is they're only interested in you to the extent that they can see that you are able to help us to succeed and whatever that means. So succeed might be, as a coach, you might think success is winning on the pitch, but as a player, you might think that success is having a great time. You know, so you shouldn't even assume that everyone's got the same measure of what success looks like. So people aren't interested in you for your characteristics. They're only interested in you as the representative of this group, and because of your ability to help us to become clearer about who we are. So what leaders do is they help us to become clearer about who we are. They advance the group, so they go out, they champion us, they get resources for us, they do the things that are necessary to help us to exist. They behave in a way which is consistent with us, so they're like a good role model of us. And they embed us into the processes and the rituals and the routines that are around us. So they make us enduring in some way. They orchestrate things around us that make us feel that we have some sort of permanence, if you like. So those are the four roles. And there's been a lot of research on this by a guy called Haslam, and Steve Reicher is another one. There's a book called Togetherness by a guy called Matt Slater, which is really good on this sort of stuff. So togetherness is applying it in a sporting context. And the research is really quite compelling that leaders who do that kind of thing are much more likely to be followed and to have a positive impact on performance. So there's some research done in Belgium by Catherine Franson a couple of years ago, I think. So she's at Leuven University, and it was looking at athlete leaders in football teams. And the research that they did, they established that when you have strong athlete leaders, and they define what that looks like, when you have successful athlete leaders who are performing these roles that I just described, teams win more. And the intermediary between that is social identity. So the research that we did, so I funded some research at Sussex University a few years ago, and we looked at 52 sports teams. Some of them were elite, some of them were amateur, across a range of 13 sports, I think it was, and three countries. First thing we did was we measured the extent to which people identified with the team. So the players identified with the team. And the second thing we did was we asked them to rate how they thought their performance was. And the third thing we did was we measured how well they were doing on the pitch. So obviously multiple different sports, you need a formula to sort of get equivalence across the sports. But you know, how successful were they? And what we found was that the 20% of teams, so if you had a strong identity, the 20% of teams with the strongest identities compared to the 20% of teams with the weakest identities outperformed by 53%. So that's not a marginal gain. That's Leicester City winning the Premier League. You know, that's how you can account for these extraordinary things.
And does togetherness precede winning, or would winning, do they go in together, or what's...
Yeah, really good question. So some coaches say, all I need to do is get a round of three or four wins together and then everything's going to be fixed. And because of the design of the research that we did, we were able to establish causality. So what came first? And so winning doesn't lead to identification, but identification does lead to winning. So identity comes first, togetherness comes first.
Nice, and I can recommend the book Togetherness because it's also quite easy to read.
Yes, it's one of my favourite books because it's short.
Short, so short.
And it's got some pictures, I love it.
Yeah, when I got it, I was like, oh, this is quite small. And I thought, oh, that's good. Well done, Rusty.
Yeah, exactly.
who does this well? So give me some examples of great men or great women, and what have you noticed when you've observed them in action? Because one thing...
Okay, let me flip it. So who are the best coaches?
Yeah, I mean, and because we chatted earlier as well about often we see stuff, it's not until we can get to go and observe and hang with people regularly and actually see what it's like and speak to the people that are being led or coached and get their view on it that often we see this, you know, and I think it's a challenge for a lot of coaches that most, you know, it's a bit like Facebook, everyone puts their best holiday snaps on. So everyone's coming across as we're doing all this great stuff, and then you often go and discover the reality. But where have you noticed it done really well?
Well, let me ask you, who would be your coaching hero? Who's the coach who you think is the most outstanding?
Wayne Smith.
Right, okay.
Closely followed by John Fletcher. I've got to say that for Fletch, otherwise...
Yeah, bless you.
Otherwise he'll kill me. In person, Fletch. And it's interesting because people would think he's just like a kid's coach. I just don't think that's the case. But of the people I've met and spoken to, Wayne Smith, and probably because of the people I've spoken to that have been coached by him. So I've spoken to lots of players who would describe it as, just the way he moved them on, the way he spent time with them. Budge Pountney said to me, Rusty, at the end of the season, I was mentally exhausted from having to think. And I'm not speaking to any players at the moment who are saying, Rusty, I'm mentally exhausted from thinking.
So Wayne Smith, so I'm friends with a guy called Anton Oliver, who played for the All Blacks for a little while. And Wayne Smith made Anton captain of the All Blacks back in whenever it was, 2002, something like that, before he ruptured his Achilles, and that was him out for a year and a half. And the way that Anton describes Wayne Smith is that he's a walking empath. He says he just has this incredible ability to connect with people and to connect people. And so he felt like his greatest strength was that he created this sense of togetherness. And if you look at the All Blacks story of their sort of transformation, so it was sort of around about 2004, 2005, where they started getting their act together. That transformation was a culturally led transformation. And so this was, Graham Henry had come in at this point, but Smithy was, I think, had moved across to be the assistant coach. And they went on tour to South Africa, lost to South Africa, were having a poor season by All Black standards, which means they'd lost half their games. And after the match, they all went and got drunk. And they got so drunk that there were All Blacks lying on the floor by the side of the path, you know, sort of comatized. They were so drunk. And on the plane going back to New Zealand, the story goes that Graham Henry went over to Smithy and said, you know, is it always like this? And Smithy said, well, yeah, it is a little bit. And he said, well, I don't think I want to be part of it then. He said, this is not what I had in mind at all. So I don't want to be part of it. So they got off the plane. They got some of the players. I think it was Tana, Richie, you know, a few others, the sort of leadership group, if you like, which didn't exist back then. And they went to Graham Henry's house and they locked themselves away for 3 or 4 days, just talking and together figuring out what they were going to do about this situation. And they realized that it was fundamentally, it was a cultural problem. So they had great players. They just culturally couldn't, you know, they couldn't sustain performance. So I think that the All Blacks story, and I think Wayne Smith's role in it, is a really good example of, you know, a culture doing something that was quite pioneering at the time. I mean, obviously we hear about, you know, the risk here is what, so there's a bias in our judgments about this. So we only hear about the people who are successful, right? So we could look at someone like Graham Henry, and we could say he's an example of a great coach, and these are the characteristics of him. And you could say the same if you, obviously Jurgen Klopp is being talked about positively at the moment. Pep Guardiola is being talked about very positively.
What you're going to say is that the Hove Colts coaches could be potentially some of the best coaches in the world, but because you're not winning World Cups, then people aren't that, you're not on the front page of the papers just yet.
You could say that, although probably if you were one of the players, you wouldn't say that. but my point was simply that it's very hard for us to make comparisons. But when you do make comparisons, what you realise is it's not really about the coach. So what Klopp has done, what Pep Guardiola has done, what Smith, Henry, that dynasty. I think the great thing about the All Blacks is they managed to pass it on, which I think is an extraordinary achievement. But what they've done is they've created cultures which were appropriate for their situation. So the situation for Pep Guardiola is very different to the situation for a national coach, for instance. So your mistake you make if you're a national coach or coaching the under nines, you know, is to simply look at these, you know, great successful coaches and their media profiles, and then say, what I need to be is be like them. But you don't, because you're not in their situation. But what you could do is you could do the things which they're doing. So what I did with Anton Oliver is that we went back over what had happened. So he was in this leadership group during this transformational period of the All Blacks. And we went over and we reanalyzed what they did using the sort of criteria coming from the research. And what we discovered was that there are, you know, basically what the research says you should do is what they were doing. They just didn't know that they, you know, they weren't doing it for that reason. They were finding their own way. But as I say, the research says, so the second part of our research with Sussex was to say, if identity drives performance, and we know that it does, and by the way, it's not just performance. So there's lots of research around resilience, people feeling less stressed, people learning more quickly. I mean, it's not really that surprising, is it? You will learn more quickly if you feel like you're in a safe environment where you trust the people around you, that you feel included and that you belong. And if you mess up, you're not going to be ostracized, right? You will learn more quickly. It's just really obvious when you put it like that. And I think each of these elements, you can see it's pretty obvious.
Can I ask a genuine question? So is there any benefit to not belonging, to being separate from a group, to being, yeah, I mean, are there benefits to that?
For the individual?
Yeah.
I think if you're separate on your own, no. I think if you're separate in a group, maybe.
Okay.
So that's one way to be distinctive, is to be separate. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, just curious. The other thing you said that I just wanted to pick up on, you said they passed it on, which is extraordinary. Why did you say that's extraordinary?
So you asked earlier about how do you bring this stuff to life? So how do you turn a conversation that you might have? And by the way, if you just have one conversation for half a day, then you're not going to have any sustained impact. You might pique people's curiosity, but it doesn't signal a change. So what you're doing is you've got to go from a stage of creation or co-creation, which is just conversations. It all sounds very swanky and difficult when I call it co-creation. But if we call it, you're going to have a series of chats with the lads about stuff. And here are five topics you really ought to be chatting about. And it doesn't matter whether you're chatting with the lads, you know, before training, during training, after training, whether you do it in a formal session or informal session. What you're trying to do is just get some agreement about some fundamental areas about who we are. So that's stage one. And then stage two is to bring that to life. So if you decide, for instance, that you are going to make the distinctive thing about your team that we're going to play really fast rugby. So we're going to play the fastest rugby. And you all discuss that and you get buy into it and you agree to it. And it's not just a coach down thing, but it's something which the players have been involved with. And it's got these other areas around it which support why that's the right direction to go in. If you do that, then you need to start to embed some things to make that real. So you need to start measuring things like how fast you play. You need to start thinking about when you're doing training, you know, what are the objectives of your training? You need to start thinking about when you do post-match analysis, what are the objectives of that? I'll give you an example actually from the Great Britain men's hockey team from a few years ago. So they had a guy called Simon Crampton who was their psychologist at the time, and he told me this story. So they'd been doing some stuff around values, and they had come up with a list of values, and then they decided what they were going to do is, instead of giving the man of the match award to the best player, however that was judged, they were going to do it based on the players' votes for who had lived the values the best during the match and on match day and in the preceding days. And they went out for a competition in Australia, I think, and apparently were woeful, got really spanked and came off the pitch. And the immediate reaction was, well, we're not going to give a man of the match because we were all so poor. You know, there was no one to give it to. And then I think, I don't know whether Simon or someone else said, well, hold on a minute, we really ought to follow through on this. And they went on and they had their debrief conversation ended up, I think it lasted about 3 hours, just discussing that actually what had happened in this game was that none of them had really lived the things that they'd agreed, that they'd agreed because they would drive their performance and their success. And none of them had really been living it in the days running up to that. And Simon said it was just like the most amazing debrief that they ever did when he was part of the team. So that's bringing it to life, right? So that's not looking at you missed this tackle or you didn't stick to this game plan or, oh, you know, the number of rucks you hit was down or whatever the metrics are that rugby teams are a bit drawn to. It's more looking at what are the behaviours and what are the beliefs that we believe that we've agreed will drive our performance, and are we sticking to them? Are we being honest to them? And it should be the coaches and everyone in the performance staff who's kind of part of that. And so if you're thinking about that and you're coaching the under eights, then, you know, it is thinking about, well, if you can figure out what we're all about and who we are and what holds us together. And it might be that you're doing it with your 8 year olds, because I think they can have those conversations. I did. So we have a model. Just as a side story, we have a model which we put together, which we call Tribe. And Tribe stands for the five beliefs that drive, that motivate people to identify. And I got a call from a head teacher of a local junior school to us. And he said, I've heard about this thing, you know, and I wondered if you'd do it in schools. And I said, well, I can explain to you how to do it. So to cut a long story short, I briefed him. He then went and ran a session in the staff room about togetherness in the staff room across the school, which was very successful. And a number of the teachers then said, well, we should be doing this with our children. And so they did it in classes. So a couple of classes of 8 year olds went through these conversations. They spent a day going through these conversations. And he sent me what they'd produced afterwards. And it was just magic. You know, kids get it. They understand what it means to belong. They understand what it is like to be together. And then adults come along and mess it up for them because we think we know best. So,
yeah, people would say, and people would also say, well, those kids are too young to have these types of conversations and they're just not. They'll say what they're thinking. Often I think it's harder to have the conversations with the adults because the kids will just blurt it out.
Yeah, and, you know, I think every group that anyone works with, they think it's the hardest, don't they? So, like you say, with small children, we say they're not able to think in those ways. Well, actually, they are. With teenagers, we think that it's going to be difficult because they're just going to grunt at us. But actually, you know, the work that you're doing as a teenager is all about figuring out where do you belong. So again, if we look at neurologically what's happening for teenagers, they're going through this process called neural pruning, which is them sort of simplifying their brain structure and figuring out, who they're going to be. So it starts to become neurologically established. And a lot of that work, especially when you're sort of 15, 16, 17, 18, is about figuring out who I am in relation to other people. That's where most of your pruning activity is going. So you think someone's in training is not concentrating and you think they're daydreaming or they're being disruptive, but the chances are they're thinking about some perceived slight which made them feel excluded just a few minutes ago. And it might have come from you because you casually kind of like, perhaps thinking you were being funny, sort of come up with some comment which because you don't have a sense of what the togetherness of us is and they don't have a sense of what that is, it's just interpreted by each individual as sort of violating that. So that's going on at all ages. So then, of course, if you engage them in those conversations, they like it.
So when you're coaching at Hove, is that your number one thing, togetherness? I mean, I think lots of coaches would coach differently if togetherness was their most important factor. They would be probably speaking more about people's strengths, what they bring to the team. They would introduce people differently. They might give more people playing opportunities. They might speak to people they don't speak to as often, more often. Because when you said that, I immediately thought of times when I've definitely got it wrong as a coach, and you can have a significant impact upon someone's sense of belonging.
Yeah, definitely togetherness is really important in the way that I approach coaching, and we talk about it a lot. And we talk, you know, some of it's about the language that you use. So always talking about us and we, and if that doesn't feel authentic to you, then that's because there is no us or we in your mind. And that's a problem. So, you know, if it's not rolling off the tongue naturally, it's because you're not there and you need to get back and establish some of these beliefs for yourself.
The pronoun test is always a good one, especially when people lose. It'll often go from us and we to I.
Yeah, that's right. I would definitely say togetherness is important. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to reference it all the time and to be inclusive. But I think also, you know, I know when so sports psychologists often talk about athletes having an A game, a B game and a C game. And so your A game is when you're on it, and, you know, you're in the zone and you're focused and concentrating. And then your B game is sort of when you're not quite on it. And your C game is when you're terrible. And what you're trying to do with most athletes when you work with them individually is to make sure that they're always playing with their A and their B game. It's not realistic to always be playing at your A game. It's just not going to happen. And if you set that expectation, you're only setting disappointment up. So accepting your B game and thinking how good that is and trying never to be playing in your C game, which is poor. And I think it's the same for coaches. You know, it is true that sometimes we're going to be coaching in our B game because we've got stuff going on in our lives. And I know there's been a lot of discussion recently about career coaches, you know, salary coaches and that kind of stuff who are doing it for the salary. But that's a factor, right? That's just the reality of it. But if you're not a salaried coach and you're doing it as a volunteer, you've got a whole load of other stuff that's important to you too. So I think it's more about, you know, so I would say when I'm on my B game, I'm not really talking about togetherness and I'm not thinking about it. I'm distracted onto something else. I've lost my focus. When I'm on my A game, I'm quite good at it. And sometimes I slip to my C game and, you know, and then I go home and I, you know, it's head in hands and you're thinking, oh God, did I really say that? You know, well, how much damage have I done? I hope not too much. And I would pick up the phone. I'd send someone a message afterwards and I'd say, you know, when I said this or did this, that was wrong. Because I think us is more important than me in that context.
The other kind of observation, and I was just thinking about, and then I got one more question, was, so Wayne Smith wasn't the head coach. So he's also been, you know, lots of people I see that are really influential in this. My question, I guess, is like co-creation, can it happen without the blessing of the, I'm going to put my hand up to symbolize the person at the top of the pyramid. And I've been in environments where they've definitely tried to say, look, we're going to try and do this bottom up and influence the top. Now, Wayne Smith clearly would have had a strong relation, you know, and he's, I just wonder what your views are around, I often hear that. Is it top down or is it bottom up or is it both? Or what are your thoughts when you hear that type of conversation?
I think it's really hard to do it if the head coach is pulling in a different direction. And the example I would give is within football. So if you look at elite level football, you've got a really odd dynamic that's you don't see in other organisations, where you've got a manager who really can't lose three games on the trot without getting sacked. Right? So their interest is short-term success. You've then got a director of football who probably is the manager's boss, who's much more interested in long-term development of the club. And those two don't always approach success in the same way because their time frames are different. So in successful football clubs, I think you have an alignment between the director of football and the manager and actually the fans, of course, and therefore the players kind of fall in with it. So if you look at Liverpool, you know, what does Jurgen Klopp do when Liverpool win the championship? The first thing he talks about is the people of Liverpool and the history of Liverpool. And how they've been doing it for Liverpool. And Liverpool's their inspiration. So he's buying into this idea of us, of identity, even though his accent isn't very Scouser. And what I imagine is his boss is doing exactly the same thing. And I went and spent a day at Man City a few seasons ago. And, you know, fascinating to see what they've been doing. So they've got superstars who are being paid, you know, gazillions for playing there, that could be paid even more than that by going somewhere else. So how do you keep those guys interested in us and putting Man City ahead of you know, the other interests that they might have, which might be around me? They've got agents who are after, you know, pushing towards me. So the challenges, you know, they're different at different levels, but they're always there. And if you don't have that sort of agreement, I think at the top, it's really hard.
Yeah, I agree. And then my last question, I've got millions more, but we can't do a whole day worth of pod. how would you select leaders?
The pubs open, Rusty.
Yeah, how would you select leaders? So recruitment for me is like so poorly done in sport. Like we don't observe people, we don't get enough information on them, we don't speak to people that have been coached or led by them, we don't think about our context and how we play and have they coached like that before. Or what's your advice? When have you seen this done well? Because Jurgen Klopp is a great, you know, is a now looks like they did some real good recruitment, and I'm definitely thinking like, what did they do? What did they notice? What made them select him over? You know, and rugby's a classic where often people will just move around from club to club, and they'll go, right, I'm changing the culture, we're starting again, and thinking, oh my days, not again.
Yeah. So I suppose what I'd be thinking is I'd want to know what a coach or a manager's you know, what their objectives were, what their plan was, and what their sense of us was. So, you know, Leeds United is another good example. So Leeds just got promoted, right? And having had God knows how many years down in the lower division.
16.
There we are. So Leeds really lost its way, I would say. So you would see a lot of rebellion, a lot of anger from the fans towards the players and towards the manager and towards the owners over the years that it was owned by different people. And since it got its new owner, what is it, about 2 years ago now, what they've tried to do is rediscover Leeds United. And by looking back at the past of Leeds United and then building some sense of meaning and connection with the fans, they've created a situation where you can take a manager, you can take players from, you can pluck them from different environments, but you're already bringing them to something that's strong. So I'd want to look at how does that coach or that manager buy into this sense of us? What does he know about it? And what's his sensitivity to sort of getting involved in that? And I think there are differences. So, you know, I think Jurgen Klopp's history is one of going to clubs that are not doing so well, but have got big fan bases and then going on and making them successful. So he is good, I would say. I imagine what he's good at is observing, listening, absorbing, and then trying to enhance and build from what's there rather than create something new. And I'd probably contrast him with Mourinho. Let's just bear in mind, I mean, we've also, you talked about The Last Dance earlier, so we don't really know what's going on behind the scenes, do we? But you contrast him with someone like Mourinho. What Mourinho does is he imposes him onto a club, whatever that club is. So you're buying this fully loaded package, really. It will be his way of doing things. And what's gone before is irrelevant. So in some circumstances, that's worked. But where it has worked is at clubs that didn't really have a tradition of success, like Chelsea, for instance. Oh, and a bucket load of money helped, obviously, to buy the very best players. But I don't think that's a long-term sustainable solution. I think that if you want long-term success, then you have to think about how do we build? So if you look again, come back to the All Blacks, so come back to the rugby, they're very good at promoting from within. What they're doing is they're looking for people who maintain what they've got and allow it to adapt and morph as is required. They're probably going through a period of reinvention at the moment. But because they've got a strong sense of who we are, I think that they'll probably be successful. You could make, I mean, I don't know, maybe you'd say Saracens was another example. Hove Rugby Club, obviously.
Hove Colts.
Very strong on that, mate.
I was thinking the other day about the pod and what the purpose of the pod is. And one of the main things for me is to spark curiosity in people. You've definitely piqued my curiosity even more. My favourite phrase, I know you can have by your tapestry, is just that he's a walking empath. And I think that responsiveness of leaders and coaches is the thing that that I've noticed in people that do it really well. Wow, mate, it's been awesome. Where can people reach you if they want to reach out? I'm going to do some one-worders in a second, but where can people reach you?
Get to me on Twitter, Jeremy J. Holt, or send me an email, which is jeremy@cfte.co.uk. That probably best way is LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Beautiful. One word is, you know the script, hopefully. I say one word, you say one word back.
Yeah, and I do it quickly, right?
Anton Oliver.
Legend.
Jurgen Klopp.
Innovator.
Psychology.
Science.
Speedway.
Raw passion. Is that two words?
That's cool. You can hyphenate it. Rugby.
Family.
Coaching.
I can't have passion again, can I?
No.
Yeah. Oh, damn. Love.
Leadership.
Fun.
That's a good one. I like that. And last but by no means least, Hove Colts.
Togetherness.
Yeah, of course. What a great one to finish on, mate. Thanks so much. Been brilliant. I've written a lot of notes. I'm looking forward to exploring some stuff a little bit more as well. Have a great day, and we'll catch up soon.
Brilliant. Thanks, Rusty. Enjoyed it too. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, dude.